greetings from Billingstown and the People's Temple Agricultural Project. I'm Mike Prokes, and with me today... Wait a second, I'm going to say something about the...
How's it going? Do you want to talk louder? Okay, this is it right now.
Greetings from Jonestown and the People's Temple Agricultural Project. The music you've been listening to is played by the Jonestown Express, our brass band, and one of our singing groups, whom you may have heard in various churches and night spots, the Cultural Center in Georgetown. Today, we are very privileged and honored to have with us Don Freed. Don is from the United States. He has written a prize-winning play about the Rosenbergs. He's written books about the assassinations of President John F. Kennedy and Senator Robert Kennedy. His books have been used as the basis for great motion pictures, such as The Parallax View. He's currently involved in an investigation of the truth behind the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, the great civil rights leader. Don has come to visit Guyana, and he's impressed with the socialist direction this country is taking. After hearing about the work being done by People's Temple in Jonestown, Don became interested in seeing it for himself. We're with him now in a lovely setting at his cottage here in Jonestown. And Don, first of all, on behalf of those with me, Harriet and Dick Tropp and Lee Ingram, let me say how happy we are to have you here with us.
Thank you very much.
You have seen the People's Temple community in Jonestown. Could you give us some of your reflections and observations, not only on the nature of the project, but of its significance?
If you look at Jonestown, where it's come from, I was shown the original two buildings, and in the last year, this burgeoning plan of buildings and agricultural and semi-industrial patterns of growth. If you look at those, and then you read some of the oral histories of the people in Jonestown, you're driven to the conclusion that the most extraordinary material and social experiment is being carried out basically by a population, a large percentage of which in the United States were not considered useful, in fact might have been considered non-entities, either too old, too young, too unskilled, uneducated, with burdensome personal records, either of addiction or health problems or incarceration in state or federal prison. One way or another, all those with two strikes against them and who would have been and or were forced out of the North American job market, and indeed those with no identity who would have been forced back upon the institutional life of the state. And to see these same statistics translated into people singing, as I saw last night, and taking part in a very full cultural activity, working during the day in really sophisticated, you would not say nation building, except that the relationship to Guyana is quite clear, and the sense of identity of Jonestown as a part of Guyana, and Guyana as a part of the world, that seems to be quite clear in the worldview of everybody working here. To see the work during the day in this really sophisticated kind of... This is not like... it's quite unique in that it's not like American versions of the Oneida community and utopian experiments of the 19th century, which eventually foundered, broke down because of family problems and social problems. This is not could not be called a utopia, it seems to me. It really is a sophisticated socialist dialectical materialist experiment, and the dialectic between the people here, where they've come from in the United States, each one with their story and their past, the heavy collective past of suffering, you might say, that you find in the oral histories, and then this sort of existential present as the jungle gives way to schools and dispensaries and agriculture and culture, and with its future orientation, its planning, and its expansion for the future, I think no place in the world offers a microcosm of what we loosely call human nature, of its amazing plasticity. This is in a model what has been seen in a large scale in China and in Cuba, and in a large scale on the negative side, I think, in the Holocaust in World War II. But here it's small enough, some 1,000 or 1,200 people, as to be able to be measured with the naked eye. One can walk around the community. And so you can, and a single individual here, can abstract what's happening at Jonestown in a way that no traveler to China, for instance, can. And so the impact on the individual visiting here is, it would be as if you were 10,000 people studying China. So you have an exponential impact here. And although I'm talking on at great length, it's really because I'm at pains to find the words to describe what is essentially an unspeakable experience, though I have no doubt it will be spoken about and written about widely, and there will be a steady traffic through Georgetown on the way to Jonestown in years to come.
From your observations, Don, how would you account for the change in people's lives who have come here and who have had problems in their past?
These people feel, I think you'd have to use the word love as the catalyst. There seems to be a context here of energy that draws upon work and love. And I would say also a chance to express through work and through a kind of ideology, a growing and changing ideology, negative feelings and aggressive feelings, hostile feelings towards conditions of oppression, which were expressed in the past through self-destructive acts in the United States. That is, there was no vocabulary for the individual sufferer in North America, and so poor health, either through masochistic, I say enjoyment, but institutional support because of poor health, institutional life in prison, or through drug or alcohol addiction, or through violence of one kind or another, and the accompanying guilt. This paralyzes people who have now been released, and where they hate and where they express hostility towards conditions which sadistically and persistently ruin their lives, undermine their lives and their families, they now express anger and outrage and frustration without guilt and in good faith and in a systematic view, which could be called the socialist worldview of the class struggle. So that individual resentments and frustrations are abstracted up into the world of the class struggle. And the guilt is removed, and the anger is liberating, and is translated into the community and nation building that lies before them. So where, in this sense, it's impossible to talk about love and hate, because what starts out as hate quickly turns over into work, and into energy, and into constructive building, which in turn is love, which reflects back then an environment and institutions which support the children, support the seniors, support those who have been culturally deprived, and provides an outlet. You see great talent here, for instance, on the part of people who would otherwise might at the outside have taken part in a drama club in a state prison. That would have been probably the extent of their cultural activities. But here you see that what we would in the individual psychology call hate or love instead is a field of energy, a dialectic of struggle and of care, which is reflected outward towards a sort of class, a class family around the world, and inwards towards the members of the Jonestown community, ranging from the infants to the seniors.
We're talking with Don Freed, the famous author and playwright and investigator of conspiracies such as those that took the lives of Dr. Martin Luther King and the Kennedys. Don, I just have one more question I'd like to ask. I know the others are anxious to ask you questions, but we've never viewed our cooperative lifestyle and community here necessarily as a panacea. If it serves to inspire others to achieve good things, we're grateful. But you called it a microcosm. Does that mean that what we're doing here could be applied to most any community or society successfully?
Well, Jonestown is a gamble in human nature. We've been told from the beginning that if you take people, even from the best educated and best supported class, and put them apart in an arbitrary community, that soon the strongest will have garnered the power, and soon there will be slaves, and soon there will be masters, soon there will be war, and we will see a deadly and monotonous repetition of all of the ills of the super-industrial state, because we are told that is human nature, that is its African genesis, that is its territorial imperative, that is its poison gene, as Arthur Kessler has called it, and that is its killer legacy. That cannot be true, because Jonestown exists. And here you see people, many of them not from the educated class, not who have been highly civilized in a rich home environment, and yet you see the essential lineaments of civilization here, of quote, not just cooperative work, but a kind of multilingual approach. Everybody is able to speak everybody's language. The different generations speak different languages. The different workers from different fields speak different languages. The different tasks of administration and organization and work all have different languages. And yet I see the people here at Jonestown move amphibiously, if I may use that word. They work with the children. They work with the old people. They work with the doctor. They work in the field. They work in the jungle. They work in the handicraft. They work. Well, what this requires is, this is extremely sophisticated human behavior across a wide scale of languages and skills. It shows that the monotonous and routinized life of workers, as we have been taught to believe was the only way to work and live, is a pitiful caricature of what could be. And Jonestown gives the lie to all of those myths, and in fact shows the what Norman Mailer called the Renaissance locked in the unconscious of the dumb.
We really need several hours to derive the benefits of this man's vast knowledge and understanding in a number of fields: sociology, social anthropology, psychology, the arts, and, well, you name it. Don, what are you working on now?
I'm working on several projects. The Martin Luther King case is coming to a climax. I'm working on that. I'm working on something called The War Against the Panthers, which is a study of what was done to the Black Liberation Movement by literally a war of counterinsurgency by American Secret Service and American Secret Police in the 1960s. I'm working on a popular history of the Central Intelligence Agency, and I'm working on a new approach to Shakespeare's Macbeth.
Thank you very much for being with us. Don Fried, author, playwright, and investigator of conspiracies. He's just told you what he's now doing. We'll be talking with him next week on some of the things that he's described. Dick and Harriet Lee, I'm sorry you didn't have time for questions, but we'll hear from you in the next broadcast. Until then, we invite you, as always, to write us with your comments and suggestions on the People's Temple work here in Guyana. On behalf of Comrade Jim Jones, Don Fried, and all of us here in Jonestown, all the best. Greetings from Jonestown and the People's Temple Agricultural Project. The music you've been listening to is from the Jonestown Express, our brass band, and one of our singing groups. Again, we're privileged to have with us today Donald Fried, who has come to Jonestown to visit and make a study of the life here. As well as being a famous author and playwright, Don is an anthropologist, a linguist. He's taught at some of the best universities in the United States, including Yale, UCLA, and others. He's co-director of the Citizens Commission of Inquiry with Mark Lane, who you may know, recognizes the author of Rush to Judgment. Don has also written a prize-winning play about the Rosenbergs. He's written books about the assassinations of President John F. Kennedy and Senator Robert Kennedy. His books have been used as the basis for motion pictures as well. He's currently involved in an investigation of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. With me is Harriet Tropp, who is an administrative officer of the Jonestown Project, and Dick Tropp, headmaster of the Jonestown Community School. Dick, what would you like to begin with?
Thank you, Mike. Don, your dedication in probing and uncovering the cover-up of the assassination of Dr. King, I know, is based not only on a desire to get at the truth, but upon a love and respect and understanding of Dr. King and his desire for a world of brotherhood, and I would say, in a sense, an understanding of the nightmare of injustice that claimed Dr. King might help to illuminate Dr. King's dream for a different sort of world. And Don, you have said that the People's Temple community represents what Dr. King, had he lived, might have recognized as the next step toward the realization of his dream of brotherhood. And I was wondering if you might elaborate a little on that comment.
It would be interesting, wouldn't it, to compare Resurrection City, as he had planned it, for Washington, D.C. in the spring of 1968, where his Poor People's March was headed, multiracial, anti-imperialist, demanding economic justice, and militantly nonviolent. It would be interesting to take that blueprint as it was emerging when he was cut down in Memphis and compare it with Jonestown 10 years later as it exists. And there is more than a dialectic there, it seems to me. In many ways, there is an identity. The style of leadership is different, and that is bound to be. And some of the vocabulary is different because of the radical Christian orientation of the old Southern movement as it emerged into its Northern and pre-socialist phase at the time of the King assassination. But if you make allowances for that, I think the most fascinating correspondence could be made between Resurrection City and Jonestown, because the people here are very much citizens of Resurrection City, whether they were there or not. This is 10 years later. It is not in the shadow of the nation's capital, mm-hmm. Just the opposite. But then there have been many gunshots in those 10 years that tend to create a distance between the nation's capital and its poor.
Very true. I remember I was at Resurrection City in 1968, and I know very well what you mean by being under the shadow of the capital. It was quite an experience. And I appreciate your comments along those lines. Again, today we are talking with author, investigator Don Freed, who we're privileged to have here with us in Jonestown. And he has brought the truth to people around the world about the murders of President Kennedy, his brother Robert, the Rosenbergs, and now Dr. Martin Luther King. Don, I'd like to ask you, how does your interest in People's Temple, in a sense, fit in with these other interests? Now, you've mentioned that there's a kind of dialectical relationship between the achievement of Jonestown as a kind of model, a kind of representation of socialist cooperation, of human liberation, in a sense, of evolution of a community consciousness. How do you see that that achievement related to, in a sense, the attempts by what we have been exposing ourselves as a conspiracy, as organized efforts to try to tear it down?
I suppose it's inevitable, and it is a function of a social reorganization for there to be attempts to destroy it. Why? I think several reasons. First of all, there's a change in the relationship of power, either actually or, as in this case, symbolically. But the difference between the actual and the symbolic in the highly technologized, media-oriented culture such as the United States is very thin. A model like Jonestown can be spread quickly these days. It no longer takes word of mouth. There is media, and it spreads quickly. And so it's dangerous in that sense, in that it undermines the regnant myths of the American culture. And besides that, there is a sort of mysterious hostility and envy towards any new, fresh attempt that gambles on human nature, and that rises above cynicism and despair, and operates not on any blind, optimistic hope, but on a functioning day-to-day actualization of the group's potential. And in that respect, that mystery, I think, is best summed up by that most mysterious of villains, Iago, who, as he lies in wait to kill Michael Cassio, the lieutenant whom he envies, he states to himself, but for the audience, there is a beauty in his daily life which makes me ugly. And I think that that somehow is true. You know, the more guilty people become, the more violent they become. And as the war in Vietnam escalated, the guilt in the United States and the violence escalated at the same time. And I think here, where people who have been thrown away, who have been labeled as rejects from the system, where they, together with declassed intellectuals, make a community, a new community like Jonestown, there has got to be a response from power. And there will be, and there is, and it will take many forms. Now, in the United States, you know, we do not have a category of political prisoners or political crimes or even political epithets. You can call people reds, but it isn't done in the more polite press. It's done differently. There's an attempt to criminalize political people. And that's true whether it be the Black Panthers or whether it be the People's Temple or whether it be even the Communist Party in the 1950s. And so always we see the use of what's been called sexpionage, dirty tricks. Watergate was a good example of some of them, just a part of the panoply. But to criminalize the political insurgent or those with a different perspective, social and political perspective, rather than give credence and argue it out on the basis of the ideas, rather than test it in the arena of civilized dialogue, there is the unfair attempt to criminalize those who are making the leap into a new kind of community.
Very true. I agree with that. And in a sense, that's almost a kind of archetypal theme in many respects throughout history. The people who are trying to extend to new frontiers are going to be, in a sense, persecuted.
It's instructive. When J. Edgar Hoover sought the most violent epithet he could find to characterize Martin Luther King Jr., he called him the most notorious liar in the country. Well, if you assume from that statement that Martin Luther King's philosophy of justice, peace, nonviolence, and love, if you assume that that was an ideology, and it was, then you understand Hoover's statement. I mean, after all, Martin Luther King, if you could call him many things, if you hated him, why would you think up that particular epithet? Well, what would that mean? Why would that be come to mind, even? Mm-hmm. But he called him the most notorious liar in the country, therefore implying that what he was saying, and we all know what he was saying from his public speeches, mm-hmm. could not be true. Because if it was true, then J. Edgar Hoover and his worldview was doomed.
Don, you've just come from Washington from congressional hearings where James Earl Ray is testifying as to the events of April of 1968. Could you share with our audience here in Guyana some of the facts that your committee has brought to life surrounding that terrible tragedy?
We have been able to determine that the 15-year persecution by the FBI of Dr. King, which employed 24-hour-a-day surveillance, both at home and abroad, ceased just literally minutes before the gunshot rang out. That the Memphis Police Department surveillance, which included several black firemen who were followers of Dr. King and a black warrant officer named Ed Reddit, that surveillance was canceled at 4 p.m., 2 hours and 1 minute before the assassination. And it was canceled by the director of fire and police in Memphis, a man who for 25 years had worked at the high levels of the FBI, and 8 of those last years had been in Mr. Hoover's office. We've determined that the FBI conducted a secret media campaign to move Dr. King from the Holiday Rivermont Hotel, a very secure big downtown hotel, where he was on March 28, 1968, to move him from there to what was in effect a shooting gallery, the Lorraine Motel, opposite a row of flop houses in downtown Memphis. We have determined that an intelligence squad called the Destroy King Squad in the Atlanta office, that squad was put in charge of the investigation of the murder. Mm-hmm. That the FBI allowed James Earl Ray, though they had his fingerprints and his radio with his Social Security number on it and his name, within 3 hours of the murder on April 4th, it was not until April 17th that his name was first given to the public. In other words, Mr. Ray, we have determined, his role in the conspiracy was that of a patsy or a fall guy. He was not murdered after the fact like Lee Harvey Oswald. Instead, he was given several weeks to escape. He was finally captured by Scotland Yard based on information from the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, but with no input or help whatsoever from American law enforcement.
Don, we just have a couple minutes. I wanted to ask you a question that I think you partially answered before, but to personalize it a little, why do you think there are some elements which seek out and attempt to hurt such dynamic leaders as Martin Luther King, John Kennedy, and even Jim Jones, who devote their lives to serving humanity?
You know, human beings live by their interests and by their ideologies, whether they specify them or not. And they feel that their life and their lifestyle and their security and their integrity in their world is threatened when an alternative is set up which calls into question their reasons for living and their rationalizations of power. And if they are defined by their that power and by their control over others, if their personalities have been formed in that kind of context, either through inheritance or through deviation. And that is then called into question because an opposite model is set up, a comparison is made. There is usually a hysterical reaction, though it may be quite organized and planned, and it's often called intelligence in one of the ludicrous misuses of any word in any language. It is called intelligence. In fact, what it is secret and paramilitary repression of a countervailing idea as embodied by certain leadership. And those who verbalize the new idea which attracts people, they draw the lightning, they become the target, and in the forlorn hope that by silencing them, you will somehow make go away a reality which threatens the integrity of a doomed group.
Thank you, Don. We've been talking with Donald Freed, author, investigator, playwright, anthropologist, linguist. I could go on and on. We appreciated having him the last week here in Jonestown. We want to wish him the best of luck in his work. On behalf of all of us here in Jonestown, we want to invite you to write us or call us with your comments and questions on our work here in Guyana. The address in Georgetown is Post Office Box 893. Until next week, from all of us to all of you, all the best.